Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Nick Ocello. And
let's go!
We are bringing new meaning to the Tailgate Podcast because I am literally in the car driving home from Villanova's 14-12 win over Penn State. It is Super Bowl Sunday, which means that we are recording while I'm in the car so that we can start drinking quicker. Nick, we had already made the decision that you were going to host the podcast this season, but it seems even more appropriate for you to do it this time around. So I'm going to give the baton over to you as a Civic goes flying past me at 100 miles an hour.
First things first, let's make sure that our hands are at 10-2. Our eyes are on the road. There is nothing that we prioritize more than our safety. Kings supporting Kings. Terry drives safe. And yeah, after last year, I think the host role fits me better. Sometimes you would ask me, and if you're wondering, you know, I want to pull the curtain open a little bit and give the listeners a little bit about how the show went last year. Sometimes you'd ask me for analysis on a game that I saw 0% of. So honestly, I think the host fits me good. And let's kick things off. What a wild weekend of college lacrosse. Does any of it matter because Notre Dame didn't play?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say yes. Now, I'm willing to debate how much any of it matters, and I'm taking your question earnestly, because, like, here's my thing, and I'm interested in your perspective on this. So you compare it to the last 2 years. 2 years ago, we hadn't played for a year. There was so much energy and excitement coming back. A lot of really old guys playing lacrosse, which was a joke that you ran into the ground last year. The following year, we get, you know, teams coming back, a little bit more of the same. This year, it just feels like the good teams are not nearly as good at the start of the season as they have been the last 2 years, and they're going to get better as the year goes on, and it's going to be a little bit more familiar to what college lacrosse is typically like. I think we got spoiled by how good these teams were in early February and, like, completely forgot that usually it's a dumpster fire for a long time. What do you think?
I completely agree. It was a pig slop weekend. It was sloppy, passes hitting the Chinese spy balloon, drops, ground ball scrums. That, I think the clip that really highlights how February lacrosse is that Virginia-Michigan 45-second ground ball with bodies just flying everywhere. Everybody completely scared to pick up the ball. Somebody does, they get their head taken off. I think that kind of encapsulates the beauty of February lacrosse, and it just makes all these blue blood teams, you know, the Maryland's, the Virginia, or I mean Virginia won, but all the teams that you expect to be good,
Georgetown,
just puts them a little bit on Georgetown, puts them a little bit on their heels, and in the pig slop games, you can't really out talent the sloppiness, which I love. So I loved it. I loved every second of it. I was actually paying attention. And let's just kick things right off with we'll move through the games by the list of how insufferable the fan bases are. Clear number one, Hopkins pulls off the upset over Georgetown. Couple things. This Russell Melendez kid, pretty good. 4 goals with a couple of them just being, oh, he sauces up his defenseman, puts him in a blender and stings it. Hopkins seems resilient as they never let the lead put them away. Georgetown's lead putting
huge
them away.
Huge factor.
What else? What's your takeaway from that game?
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, candidly, those 2 points and then the fact that they got really sound, consistent goalie play, and it was also like the anecdote that was in Christian Sweezy's story will, like, kind of stick with me for the rest of the year, which was Tim Marcille let in a goal late. It was Georgetown's last goal and made it 13-12. And he was, according to his head coach, Pete Milliman, giggling in the huddle for the timeout after it. So if you let in a goal to bring your, you know, bring the game into a one goal game and you're giggling about it in the huddle right after, like, you got the right attitude, in my opinion. That's like, that's what you want out of your goalie, is a little bit of kookiness. But yeah, I mean, I think that was my reaction to Hopkins' win over Jacksonville as well. They fell behind 4-2 at the beginning of the second quarter. And I felt like last year, the biggest issue with this Blue Jay team was their ability to handle adversity. And the way they responded against Jacksonville, I thought, showed growth and promise. And so to fall behind by three goals on three separate occasions like they did against Georgetown, and then go on a massive run to turn an 11-7 deficit into a 13-11 win, in my opinion, it shows that the seeds that Pete Milliman has planted over the last 2 years in terms of trying to develop this culture in the way that he did at Cornell are starting to come to fruition. And so, obviously, if you're not talented enough, it doesn't matter. And the simple fact is, Russell Melendez brings an element of athleticism, playmaking, ability to score unassisted goals that this team hasn't had since Joey Epstein got injured after his freshman season and never came back with that same level of spark that he showed in a 70-point campaign in the spring of, 2018 or 2019? And either way, like, Matt Collison showed tremendous force and athleticism from the midfield. Dylan Bauer continued his hot start to the season. And there's a lot about what we saw out of the Blue Jays that, you know, I don't want to say it doesn't surprise me because I didn't, like, stake my flag and vote them as a top 20 team. But I'm not surprised in the sense that this is what I saw in the fall, and it was kind of my suspicion for what we were going to see. So a lot for Blue Jay fans to be excited about, and at the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, I think that the it's not, you know, Georgetown scored 12 goals, right? So they will be upset that they lost because they gave up 13 to Hopkins. But at the same time, I look at some of the questions around Georgetown's offense and why they only scored 12 goals. And for me, that's the kind of most enduring or lingering takeaway, especially, you know, when you flip this thing around and see what they're going to do against Penn next week.
One of the things I found most interesting was they're seemingly, and credit to John Crowley, I hate saying good things about people. I like talking shit, and I like doing it behind people's backs. But John Crowley, credit to him, he's a great guy. And what I really liked about what he was doing, there didn't seem to be a set structure or even a set line that Hopkins kept going back to. Like, they had second and third line middies hopping in at integral moments of the game. There wasn't the, hey, these are our guys and we're going to stick with them. And I think that bodes really well to whoever does rise to the top in those occasions. It's only they gathered more information about their team than Georgetown did. And I think that in the long run, starting off, whether it was intentional or not, getting everybody in the mix in what could be the biggest upset of the weekend, I like that they're going to be leaving that game going, we have depth. And another thing that I think is bananas is Melendez is not from Peterborough. I saw him dodge and I was like, huh, Hopkins must be bringing in some greasy Canadians. Turns out this kid's from Maryland.
Yep.
So I love that he plays with that flair. I think he's going to just be the captain of the ship. But I think the support around him and the depth around him, it's hopefully going to become a game of whack-a-mole. You take away one thing, another one pops up. So credit to John Crowley and credit to Hopkins. Their depth and the knowledge they took away from this team, I think, bodes extremely well for the future.
Yeah, so I think we're going to be talking about Russell Melendez a few more times this season. So let's just work on that pronunciation. If you were going to nickname him,
what did I say?
Well, you said two different pronunciations. So we're working on a third. If both of them, definitely, it was the word melon and then some sort of suffix after that. Nick, what is your favorite melon?
Cantaloupe. A nice fresh cantaloupe is undefeated in the melon game. What's yours? Or, you know, my head is also, it's been called a melon and it's looking good right now. I got some sun this weekend.
There's a podcast that, I listened to for like more than a decade with two bald guys called Men in Blazers. And it's a English Premier League podcast. I'm sure that, yes, you're much familiar with it. I'm very cultured. And I was like, we are also two bald guys who have a podcast. We should call it Men in Pennies. How often do you wear a lacrosse penny these days?
It's
every night to sleep in.
Yeah. All the frat parties, skiing. I wear it skiing over my coat like a complete jackass. If it's not specifically for playing lacrosse, it's been since pre-COVID, since I've just casually tossed on a lacrosse penny.
Do you have one particular penny that you cherish or hold dear?
No. I'm a big kind of wacky counterculture guy. So, like, even being one of the best lacrosse players of all time, I try not to make that, like, my staple personality. And they're like, oh, do you have a bunch of lax pennies? Are you a lax bro? I'm like, no, I'm a fat, bald guy. My dad isn't a lawyer. I'm from Denver. Like, I have some things going against me to break the stereotype. It just so happens I was nasty on the sticks as a midfielder. Speaking of nasty on the sticks as a midfielder, let's move on to expecting the truth.
Why can't
we move on?
Because I've got three more things
to say.
Host. You made some good points. I understand.
Okay, I'm the captain, but let's hear your points.
All right, you made some good points, and I want to reinforce them. So with respect to second and third line middies for Hopkins, your comment was about the benefit from coaching staff trust and players getting, you know, big game reps and moments. My thing is about practice. Like, if you're the fourth line middie or if you're the seventh attackman and your coach is showing a willingness to go that deep into the bench, like, how much better are your practices going to be over the course of the next 60 to 75 days with real belief that if you improve and show that improvement, you're going to get your opportunity. So I think that that knock-on effect is really substantial in terms of just creating a culture of competitiveness, competition, and everything that goes along with that. On the flip side, it's very interesting from Georgetown's standpoint because Kevin Brown, who is producing this podcast, went to practice
Great
in the
guy.
Fall and wrote extensively about how the Hoyas needed to cultivate more depth because they didn't play enough guys specifically in their NCAA tournament game loss to Delaware, and they felt like playing more guys over the course of the season was going to be an essential part of their success. I think that there's some curiosity, thought, wondering about whether or not they actually went a little too deep against Johns Hopkins, and maybe it'll be interesting to see how they adjust to that question in particular, because I felt like their biggest issue was an over-reliance on Tucker Dordovic and Graham Bundy. I felt like, you know, some of the other guys, whether it be the other new pieces like Nikki Solomon and Jacob Kelly, or some of the established known quantities like TJ Haley and Declan McDermott, just didn't kind of, I don't know, they just didn't have the same presence that I expected them to, and that, at least for the returners, that they did at times last year. Minicus, the Colgate transfer, I think got better as the game went along, but at the same time, like, it's that complementary scoring. It didn't look like they tried to push transition at all, and they certainly didn't get anything out of transition. So those are the things that I'm gonna watch for the Hoyas going forward. It's not as if they need to score more than 12 to win. I mean, they have a defense that is going to be able to stifle good offenses, or at least personnel-wise, they have a defense that should be able to. But, you know, they're going to find themselves in a couple of high-scoring contests given the quality of the opponents that they're going to face. And so in those instances, Bundy and Dordovic are not going to get them to 17. They might get them to 10 or 11 by themselves, but they're going to need those other guys that I named in order to get the last 6-7 goals. And I think that's where the focus ought to be this week heading into hosting the Quakers.
You called out a great point. I think something that is very, very, I think, misunderstood, right, is the amount of competition that players should feel the need going into practice, and knowing that you have a chance to crack a roster or a starting spot as a fourth line midfielder is crucial. The intense moments at Hopkins practice are going to feel very game realistic versus, you know, you just end up shooting the shit with all your buddies who have played at different colleges. And there's a distinct difference in how much kids enjoyed their college career when the scout team knew they weren't going to play versus if the scout team had a chance to make an impact. So we're making some assumptions, but that roster turnover and that depth that Hopkins showed is going to create a pretty fantastic practice atmosphere. So good job calling that out. Any further thoughts, or can we move on to the next game? All right. The last point before Hopkins fans, you're still all losers. Just because your team won one game doesn't mean that you get to get cocky. Your song sucks, and stay humble. All right. Moving on to the next one, let's respect the troops. Air Force. My Air Force Falcons beat in-state rival Denver University. First off, I think it goes without saying that my brief stint as a coach at Air Force was a big impact of this game. I set the culture 6 years ago that allowed them to come back. But it felt like they out-Denvered Denver. It was a war of attrition, and when Air Force got the lead, shout out Brandon Dodd, who had five goals, they played a little bit of kind of stall ball. Let's not do anything crazy. Let's try to maintain possession, Terry. Air Force takes down the Pios. What do you got?
Yeah, this one's a head-scratcher for me because I watched Ohio State Air Force last week, and I thought that, you know, the Buckeyes really handled the Falcons. It was kind of an easy one. And then, similarly, I watched Denver versus Utah, and I thought Denver handled Utah. I thought it was kind of an easy one. And so, you know, it wasn't to say that I expected it to follow exactly the same formula, but I guess the best-case scenario I would have thought was going to be available to Air Force was a, you know, keep it tight through three quarters and, you know, lose 13-10, something like that. And when you examine the history of this series, it's even more stark how impressive it was for the Falcons to put this together. And you know, they have pulled upsets over the course of the last 3 to 4 years. And when they have, such as when they beat Duke, one of the through lines, one of the common threads, was a big game from Brandon Dodd. And we got it again. And I think that it's a little bit more easily understood when you essentially say, all right, here's a guy who's going to contribute five goals to the outing. You're going to get to 12 because you only have to get seven goals anywhere else. And then, you know, when you're looking at it and wondering, how is it that Denver only got to 10? Then a lot of the questions that we started to ask about the Pioneers in the preseason really come home to roost, specifically how young they are at the offensive end, how inconsistent that likely translates them into being, and then specifically, tough test on the road, down, how are you going to respond? How are you going to, you know, find a game-changing goal late? I mean, I'm coming from a game where, you know, it was 12-12. Penn State essentially lost by committing turnovers on two successive clears, one trying to press transition, and that set up Patrick Daly's go-ahead goal with 3 minutes to go, and then they got an insurance goal late. Both of these offenses are veteran. The difference is that for Penn State, they've got two guys who missed all of last year and two transfers who didn't play for this team, whereas for Villanova, you know, they've got two guys in Campbell and Daly who were awesome and have been awesome last year and in years preceding it. So for Denver, when you look at everything they lost, Ethan Walker, Alex Simmons, Teddy Sullivan, you know, the list goes on and on, including guys that, you know, didn't make as big a contributions like Riley Curtis and Johnny Morocco, but had been there and had contributed. You know, it really was, and obviously, you know, one of the best American players playing in the NLL right now as well. Like, a lot of the burden falls onto J.J. Silstrop, and you know, I think that complimentary scoring that we talked about with Georgetown, it's even more substantial, and it needs to be even more significant for the Pioneers. And you know, I think in the fourth quarter, it let them down.
Completely agree. And it's worth calling out of all the teams, like whether we'll talk about Jacksonville in a little bit, but, or even like a High Point, you know, kind of some of these famous Duke losses or upsets, Air Force is always and has always been the number one team you don't want to run into in February. They're going to be in tip-top shape. You're probably coming off of a winter break. I knew winter break, it was going to be a long season. I sure as shit wasn't staying in shape. I was having a couple beers after I turned 21 in between my college breaks. So love to see Air Force just go out and upset DU. And Terry, I'm going to call it. I think DU's going to have a down year. I didn't see facets of their game where I was like, oh, damn, Air Force kind of snuck by them. I was impressed with Hopkins, and I was disappointed with DU, I guess. It was more of a DU loss than an Air Force one. Fair take?
Yes, and it's kind of been my expectation for this team, and I've talked to Coach Tierney about it. You know, I think that they were probably the 23rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th best team in the country in the preseason. You know, they in the fall they scrimmaged St. Joe's and the Canadian national team, and it sounded like they really took it to St. Joe's. And that was one of the few fall results that impressed me and caught my attention, because I think we both think that St. Joe's is they were excellent last year, and they're going to be really good, if not better, again this year. So that prompted me to like kind of sit up a little bit. And then, like I said, I came away very impressed by what they showed against Utah. I think Utah, maybe not as good as they were at the end of last season. We'll see whether they continue to progress over the course of this year, or if they just end up being a little bit more of a middling team this year relative to maybe some of the expectations for being a borderline top 20 team based on what they showed last year. All that being said, with Denver, I think their issues are going to be less about their ceiling and more about their consistency. And I think that's going to be the best reflection of their youth. And I think that they've already shown, I don't want to say both ends of the spectrum. I'm not arguing that their best game was against Utah and their worst game was against Air Force. But I think it's pretty clear that the team that played against Utah did not show up in Colorado Springs on Saturday. And so I think that that's what is in store for this team. You know, there's one aspect to it where you're like, oh, it's kind of a bummer. Coach Tierney's last season, you know, you want to see him go on like essentially a victory tour. But I also can say, no, do it the other way. Like he is going to earn his salary this year by virtue of coaching this team up, because that is how you combat inconsistency. You find levers to pull to keep your team's focus and confidence 5 days during the week while you're preparing, and most importantly on Saturday. And not the same every week. That's the whole point of inconsistency. So you got to get in your bag a little bit in terms of which are the levers that are going to work this week and which are the ones that aren't. And, you know, ultimately, in his final year of doing it at the college level, it'll be fascinating to see what he does. You know, he jokes all the time about how he doesn't coach his team during the game. He just yells at the refs, and Matt Brown does everything. That's not true during the week. He coaches his team during the week, and those are the levers that are going to get pulled. And certainly they're going to have a good week of practice on Monday, because he's not going to be pleased with the performance that they put in against the Falcons.
Yeah, it's going to be tough, because my hatred of DU and my respect for Bill Tierney, inside of us are two wolves, and I think I'm going to feed the hatred of DU, so congrats on stinking it up on Saturday. You shouldn't have beat us in 2015. You're a second-rate institution. Westberg, I'm sick of seeing you be way better at lacrosse than I ever was.
I've got one deep in the recesses. Have you ever heard of a movie called The Brotherhood of the Wolf?
That's a real movie?
It is. It's like an early 2000s movie that was heavily influenced by Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Okay. So it's a French movie about the French Indian War, or set in the French Indian War, but it's very mystical. There's a mythic beast that is like the villain. And then there's a Native American character who I haven't seen this movie in like 15 years. Could be very, what's the word I'm going for? Politically incorrect. And then there's a French guy, and there's like the most incredible fight scenes. It's a lot of gruesome brutality, but the special effects and the stuff that they do is outrageous. So it's on Amazon. I was looking at it because it like crossed my memory a couple weeks ago, and I was like, I wonder if I can find that like for free on YouTube. And the answer is no, but you can pay for it for like $1.99 on Amazon. And I'm just waiting for the right moment to pull the trigger on that one. I can promise you that if my wife is watching it with me, she will fall asleep in the first 8 minutes. That is good. The only guarantee that I have. So,
all right.
Lepak Talu, Brotherhood of the Wolf. Two wolves inside of Nick. That's
the Brotherhood of the Wolf. Honestly, yes. Sounds like a bit almost. All right, but moving on, I had a saying in college that I can't say, I don't think. If we have to edit it out, fine. But when people got a little too cocky and when they got brought back down to reality, we always told them, hey, you got to put that boner on ice a little bit. So if we have to edit that out, the other version of it is stay humble. You should have kept your mouth shut last year when you had 25-year-old accountants, guys who could rent cars, winning the national championship and going undefeated. My favorite outcome, Loyola beats, Maryland? The thing that was wild about this So Maryland graduated 200 years of lacrosse experience from their senior class. Yes, they were old. You accused me of running that bit into the ground. Get ready for more of that this year. The weird thing, so Luke Stewart, Loyola goaltender, apparently he's really good at goaltending because if you just look at the stats.
Stout. Close.
What?
Keep going. Stout.
I put Stewart. It might be a typo. What? The Loyola goaltender's good is what I'm getting at. How good? Maryland smoked them in face-off shots, swagger, good looks. The shots was unbelievable. Maryland outshot them at every turn. So credit to them. I think Loyola has one of the best short stick D-Mitty units in the entire country, and I think that was on display. So it's about time short stick D-Mitties finally get some credit, including names like no, you're a short stick D-Mitty. You don't get your name told. It's a thankless, faceless job. So you know who you are. Keep grinding. But we're not going to say a short stick D-Mitty's name unless Terry does. Terry, Loyola, Maryland.
Yeah, so I covered this game. I was there. First of all, you know, they announced 3,100 fans. I'm told that they had some ticket scanners that broke. So the crowd was definitely bigger than 3,100 fans. I don't know how much bigger. But it was also influential. I think that the game turned in the early part of the fourth quarter when Loyola scored three straight goals and turned what was, I believe, an 8-6 game into an 11-6 game. And, you know, and from that point, it was basically, you know, all downhill. Final was 12-7, and or maybe it was 11-7. The final was 12-7. I don't remember what the early fourth quarter scoring situation was. I mean, so first things first. The inverse of the Richmond game for the Terps. They got outshot by, like, you know, 15 or 20 against Richmond, and yet they dominated the game. Really, I think, kind of extinguished the will from Richmond after, you know, an 8-1 first quarter where Logan McNaney stole some goals, and I felt like Richmond felt like the scoreline should have been more favorable to them and never really kind of recovered from the emotional setback that represented. In addition to the fact that Richmond's still finding their identity in a post-Ryan Lansbury world. In this game, Loyola really struggled to create offense at the attack in the first 20 minutes of the game. But they got some good looks and a little bit of luck in order to keep – they built a 2-0 lead, and then they kept inching in front of Maryland. You know, whether it was a Seth Higgins goal that hit McNaney and then trickled in, there were a couple of plays like that that just put Loyola in the driver's seat and helped them develop their belief. I mean, this was a game that Maryland won 20-8 last season. You can imagine being on that Loyola sideline before the game starts. You're missing a starting attackman in Joey Kamish. You're starting two freshmen at attack. There are a couple other significant injuries, including DeMitty's Matt Houston and Ryan McGorry. So you're wondering where, you know, the offense was going to come from. And Maryland kind of, I don't want to say, like, gave it to him, because it's not as if Stout, you know, he here's my thing. I believe he finished with 19 saves, 7 in the fourth quarter. I would estimate that he made 8 or 9 saves with his legs or feet, which is just outrageous. And the question is that sustainable or was it lucky? So we asked him, Luke, how are you able to make all these saves with your legs and your feet? And he gave like I've been coached up by my SAD-esque answer. But as Charlie Toomey, the head coach, who himself was a bully about it afterward, and he was like, yeah, he has a completely different style from me. Like my feet were parallel to each other and I stepped straight toward the ball. So my feet and my legs were very much like kind of in a line. Whereas Luke keeps his in his stance, he keeps his feet pointed out, like duck foot style. And then he stepped out like that as well. So it basically just increases the surface area that you can potentially hit with the ball. And, you know, I don't want to, like, overanalyze it more than I just did, but it felt like that was a factor in maybe some of the early shooting woes. And, you know, there was some belief that Maryland shooters got a little fine after that point and started missing the cage significantly, because they were shooting for corners because they didn't want to get saved again. And I think that, you know, very reasonable that might have been one of the factors. On top of that, Loyola did an excellent job at killing possessions, whether it was rebounded shots off of saves or ground balls in the defensive end. You know, I thought that Alex Bean, who was making his first career start, he'd only played in four games as a junior, four games, two each of his freshman and sophomore year, and he's a junior making his first start now. He picked up five ground balls. I thought, you know, the rate at which those ended possessions was really impressive and important. You know, Cam Wires picked up two, and Matt Hughes picked up five. You know, when you get 12 ground balls from your three starting close defensemen, you're killing a ton of offensive possessions, and that's what we saw, especially because, like you said, I mean, Loyola got smoked at the faceoff X, and they're going to have to figure that out because you can't allow the amount of pressure that was put on that defense to persist as the season goes on. But what's interesting is Steve Agnes is considered to be probably the best faceoff coach, at least among volunteers, in college lacrosse, and their guys have a really consistent track record of getting better as the season, as seasons progress. So there is reasons for hope, in addition to which Luke Weirman probably still is the best faceoff guy in college lacrosse. But it was just a matchup that was very exacerbated in this one. And, you know, ultimately, to your point, Maryland only scored seven goals. A huge percentage of that credit goes to Luke Stout. A good percentage of it goes to the Loyola defense, both in terms of preventing them from getting to dangerous shooting positions and picking up those ground balls to end possessions. But not an insignificant portion of it, you know, goes to a bad Maryland offensive day. We saw them play well against Richmond, so I'm not willing to say that this is a complete drop off the cliff relative to the historic offense they were last year. But at the same time, it is cause for concern as guys take on new roles, bigger roles, are asked to do more, have more pressure placed on them. What's it going to look like for the, you know, remainder of the season? How much better are they going to get when they've got Syracuse coming to town next weekend?
Yeah, two things. One, it's a very real thing, and I don't know if college players, particularly on the younger side, freshmen and sophomores, think about it this way. It took me a long time to realize it myself, but difference in goalie style is that, you know, it has a very big impact on shooting, like a shooter's confidence. And like you said, you can't go into it without confidence saying, I need to sting a corner in order to score a goal. You're not going to score with that way. And looking at a guy like Dylan Ward. Yeah, whatever. My point didn't matter. Go ahead.
No, you're going to be able to finish your point. If you try to sting a corner, if you're dodging down the alley and you're trying to sting the corner on the run, if it goes in, in your opinion, is it a good shot or did you get lucky?
It's a good shot. Okay. Some shots are so good, like placed so well. Like it's something I'm becoming a much more firm believer of NLL-wise, like broadcasting. And sometimes the shot is just so well placed, the goalie didn't really have a chance. Like other times, it's off a number of factors of deception and placement and shooting patterns and everything like that. But doing it in a way that I know and guys that I know, like Dylan Ward and Blaze Reardon, when you shoot on them low, it is bouncing off of their legs. And like literally baked into the game plan sometimes would be, hey, you know there's going to be rebounds. When there's a shot, crash the net. Versus a guy like Kyle Burnlore, you shoot at his legs, he's going to catch it with his stick somehow. So huge credit to Loyola for, I don't, you know, and it could just be they had a good day, but it all could also be the emphasis of, listen, we have a goalie who's going to be pigeon foot kicking balls all over the field. Let's make a huge emphasis that as a shot's released, we need to get that ball off the ground. So credit to them. And also, yeah, on the faceoff battle, is it just because Weirman's the best, or is it because Loyola wasn't putting together a good strategy from a wing and counter perspective? What's your take on that?
I despise trying to analyze faceoffs. That is compounded by, I wrote about this last week, the, you know, kind of nuance of this referee mechanic and the way in which it can create violations and how that's changing cadence and changing guys' familiarity. But all of that is kind of predated by the fact that the biggest lingering question that I took away from the 2022 season is why and how did Weirman improve so much from 21 to 22? I mean, he went from a sub 50% guy to a 70% guy for the national champion You know, and everybody, and I think, you know, there's, it's rightful, made a big deal out of the fact that basically the last play of 2021 was him taking a shot that got saved. And you can imagine how that fuels you an entire offseason. But there are a lot of people that work really hard. Working really hard isn't enough. You also have to do the right things. And I think there's a lot to this that I need to uncover, and I just haven't made it the priority to do so, but will do so in the coming weeks. I'm very interested in the role that volunteer assistant Carol Kennedy played in Luke Wehrman's improvement, yada, yada, yada. I felt like the wing play was actually pretty equivalent. Like, you know, I didn't think that Loyola was giving anything up with Peyton Razanka at Setas, short 60 middies name,
yeah,
and Scott Middleton on the wings. So, I mean, really, it was Wehrman. He picked up 9 ground balls out of winning, I believe, 18 faceoffs. So he picked up 50% of the ground balls himself. There were a number of scraps where the ball went all over the place. I don't know how many violations there were, but there you go. Those are ground balls that are taken away. So I think that, like, Loyola's wings probably, it's possible they only got involved in, like, 5 of the faceoffs total. So, like, yeah, I wouldn't be super critical. You know, they rode with their number one a lot. They didn't go to, which is Eric Pacheco, a Denver boy. They didn't go to Chris Cattone very much. I think that'll probably change depending on how the matchup plays out and what the success rate looks like. Hopkins is going to be the complete opposite in terms of, you know, Wehrman took every faceoff for Maryland. Hopkins has shown, even without Matt Narewski, that they've got a good kind of 1-2 punch matchup-wise with Logan Callahan and Tyler Dunn. So, you know, it'll be a different face-off game. You know, we'll see offensively how much Hopkins exploits, if they do get a significant possession advantage, how much they exploit it and how much pressure they can put on the Greyhound defense.
Got it. Any other takeaways before we move on?
One huge thing to watch coming away from this game.
Ooh.
Logan McNaney wore sweatpants against Richmond. And you can kind of tell by the photos that he was wearing a knee brace underneath. I don't know this definitively, but I think he was wearing sweatpants in the first half. Maryland called timeout to start the third quarter before the first faceoff. They basically extended halftime. I'm pretty sure that McNaney came out for the second half in shorts, not wearing a knee brace. I'm going to speculate that he decided, well, first of all, I'm going to speculate that he indeed was injured in the preseason and has been injured for each of these last two games. I'm going to speculate that he thought that the brace was hampering him, and that was one of the reasons that he wasn't catching up to balls and didn't have a better first half. Then in the fourth quarter, trailing, Maryland resorted to a 10-man ride, and McNaney was flying all over the defensive end of the field. He picked up 2 ground balls. He cleared one of them. He crossed the midline. He was really putting his athleticism on display. But with about 3-4 minutes to go, he went for a ground ball near the Loyola bench. You saw his knee buckle on film. He continued out of bounds and went to the ground near the Loyola bench. It took a while for play to stop. He was able to walk gingerly, I think. I don't know that he put any weight on his right leg, but I think he did a little bit. And then he went through the handshake line. He did not return. John Tillman said postgame that he didn't know what the status was. But Logan McNaney's availability, certainly for Syracuse and then potentially beyond, is a big question coming away from this, because talking to a lot of really informed observers of Maryland's defense, you know, new third defenseman replacing Matt Rahill, a completely new suite of short zip D middies. Loyola very clearly avoided Brett Makar, Ajax Zapatello, and John Geppert, and went after the other 3 defenders that were on the field. There are some folks that know this game really well who have said to me over the course of the last 24 hours that they felt like McNaney covered up a lot of ills for Maryland's defense. We already talked about their struggles at the offensive end. If, in fact, these are some of the things that are happening at the defensive end, who knows? Maybe this Maryland loss to Loyola is a little bit more of an indicator of things to come. Maybe it's a little bit more signal, a little less noise, as far as trying to read the Division I landscape is concerned.
All right. Well, as always, we hope nothing but the best. Hope he gets back to 100%. So Credit to us for being great guys and wishing that. The next one, I mean, stop me if you've heard this before. Duke just pisses down its leg in February versus Jacksonville. Could a non-existent Wheat Ridge High School freshman team beat Duke in February? Probably. Jack Taylor and Brandon Galloway both had hat tricks. And sneaky, across the board, I feel like it was a big weekend for young kids. The freshman and sophomore stepping up. Taylor, a freshman, that at his first hat trick. And another win for team resiliency, as Jacksonville never let a lead, whether it was 10-6, whether it was early in the game, let them convince themselves that they were out of the game. They battled back late. And I'm just going to say it, Duke played bad late in the game. A tale of two halves, really, if you look at the first half versus the second half. What do you got?
The thing that shocks me is their assertiveness and dominance against High Point on Tuesday led me to believe that they had changed their personality, their persona from last year. And John Galloway talked about this with McNair postgame. That was the narrative after Duke's 2-0 start, that they had girded themselves to those letdowns that ultimately cost them an opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament. And he was like, you know what? We have a chip on our shoulder too, because we beat Duke last year. We did score some other significant wins, but we lost in the SoCon championship game. And as a result, our resume wasn't enough to get us into the tournament. I mean, candidly, it wasn't really even enough to get them considered for an at-large spot. So it was very clear that the Dolphins came out with a chip on their shoulder. You know, the storyline heading into their opener against Johns Hopkins was Max Wahlbaum's availability, and he didn't play. And it was very easy to ascribe some of their offensive limitations to his absence, because from a matchup standpoint, if you have an attackman that is guarded by your opponent's best defender and can still draw slides, that is the most valuable thing an offense can have, because it is the rarest thing that defenses have to account for, right? Like, defenses are used to sliding to their short six. Most defenses don't slide to their LSM. They're used to sliding to their third best close defenseman. Most defenses don't slide to their best defenseman, and often don't slide to their second best defenseman either. So, again, easy to understand how Jacksonville's offense can struggle when you take something so dynamic and impactful like Wahlbaum away from the team. And so the fact that they were able to essentially exploit a Duke defense that had looked pretty good in its first two games without something that significant, it says a lot. I didn't get eyes on this game. I haven't had an opportunity to watch the clips yet. It is going to be a priority. But to some extent, are you starting to wonder maybe Jacksonville has Duke's number? It's interesting. There's got to be a lot of psychology that goes into accounting for this result.
Well, I think last year was the first year, certainly for me, that I can't just laugh off a Duke loss in February, because there are very real implications. Now, the ACC teams can't just coast off of good in-game conference play and be like, oh, well, we're the ACC, so we got it. Because of the corrupt, disgusting organization that blackballs historically underserved Duke and Notre Dame, thank you very much, these games actually matter. You know, it's no longer laughing matter. And come time when, you know, already fast-forwarding way to when, you know, playoff teams are being considered, Jacksonville needs to reflect on this just as much as Duke does, because the days of coasting and tap dancing into the playoffs are over for the Blue Bloods. And it's nice that Jacksonville has that perspective as well of like, hey, this is a big game for us. We don't give a shit about upsetting Duke. We are a playoff team and we're here to stay. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. I coached against Galloway once at Air Force and I literally wanted to get into a fist fight with him. Over like the energy and intensity. He was very much acting like the player. And if I'm a recruit, I just keep seeing these go back and back and back, and Jacksonville wins, Jacksonville beats Duke. Galloway's a fun, young, energetic, exciting coach. It's good weather. I wouldn't be surprised in the next couple of years. I think Jacksonville separates themselves from the likes of High Point as a legitimate playoff contender year in and year out. And like the best of the rest, like the not ACC, the not Ivy League best team. So I like Jacksonville, and I think that this win is teeing up a lot for the entire program, more so than of years past, especially with how the playoffs played out. Anything before moving on?
Just that, you know, the second time shows that it's not a fluke. And to reinforce all your comments, I think that, you know, they're in the most interesting league in college lacrosse in the A-Sun, right? You know, huge conference schedule, go all over the country, you know, play a Pac-12 athletic department in Utah and play, you know, essentially Division II schools in Queens and Lindenwood. And you go to Charlotte and St. Louis in order to do it. So, yeah.
Wow, the Lindenwood disrespect will not be tolerated, Terrence. My cousin.
First of all, calling Lindenwood essentially D2 is a compliment because they were NIAA like 9 years ago. So, like, they are Division I now, and they have done tremendous work in order to get there. And I am going to spend the second half of a week in the end of March watching two of their games against Queens and against Bellarmine. So I'm very excited. You're not going to get me to say a bad word about the Lions. All I'm saying is that they were Division II last year, and they were only Division II for like 7 years. So calling them a Division II program is absolutely not an insult.
Wow. We have a nominee for Spin Zone of the Year, and we're only at episode one. All right, so we'll just stay with the upset. We'll talk about Spalding in a little bit. But of the following three games, what was the biggest win? You had Vermont beating Boston, the first time they won against Boston since 2014. UMass over Army, the first time they've won that matchup since 2014 as well. Or Binghamton over Marist, the first time they've won that matchup since 2011. So rounding out what was just a wild weekend of pretend college lacrosse because Notre Dame wasn't playing, these three I put into the same category of eyebrow raisers. Everybody talks about parody, and it's a very much overplayed trope in the lacrosse landscape. But of those three, Vermont, UMass, and Binghamton, what do you think is the biggest win?
So it's got to be Vermont's win over BU in the sense that that has the potential to be a valuable win. Although the margin for which that's true versus UMass's win over Army is pretty slim. The difference is that BU brought everybody back. They struggled in a scrimmage against Rutgers. You know, they played even against Villanova. So I already had my concerns and antenna on Terriers for those reasons, in addition to which I was a little concerned that they were going to be a little bit like this year's Loyola. I also feel this way about Delaware, where basically they had great seasons last year. They bring back a really old group and they just struggle to manufacture urgency, right? You can't fake desperate. The hungry dog runs faster. I don't think it's possible for BU to be desperate based on what they experienced last year. I think this was an issue in their Princeton game, and I do think that it will be an issue all season long for them this year. And so Vermont is kind of like the exact opposite. They had a great year. They won the American East for the second time in a row and the second time overall, but they graduated a bunch of really important players, including Thomas McConvey, who, you know, I've said a couple times, is arguably the best player in program history. I'm very interested in what Ian McKay would say about that. So, Vermont, like, they play Syracuse competitive. We don't know at the time who Syracuse is. We don't really know who Vermont is. Syracuse wins by two goals. It's hard to know how to react. I picked the Catamounts for every reason that I just laid out, including the fact that they had a game of experience on BU. What I'm trying to say is, like, how strongly to react. UMass is the best when we expect them to be the worst. I didn't necessarily expect UMass to be the worst. I just didn't know anything about them. I just didn't know who they were going to be. Like, the last 2 years, they've been the Tobins and, you know, a bunch of the other guys that, like, we kind of knew about. Like, this year, they're kind of similar to Army. Like, I don't know who Army is. So it's going to take a few weeks in order for us to kind of, like, really wrap our arms around it. But one of the reasons I'm struggling to answer more succinctly is because the term biggest win is it can be interpreted a bunch of different ways. And one way is, which win bolsters the program the most? And I would argue that this win means more to Binghamton than either that win means to Vermont or that win means to UMass. Because when you consider what Binghamton has experienced as a program, the adversity that it's faced the last two seasons, I mean, just some really unspeakable and uncommon tragedies, to get the season off with a win is so meaningful. In America East, that, you know, obviously Vermont rebounds with a nice win against BU, but, you know, coming away from week zero, you probably could have expected it. You could have said, like, I think it's going to be pretty wide open, you know. And not only that, but it's also bigger, right? There are more games, and, you know, there's teams that you haven't played in the league previously, so there's a little bit more that you got to adjust to. You know, for Kevin McKeon and his squad, I'm very, very happy for them, and I hope that they celebrated that win really hard, because I'm sure that it meant a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to break it down. I think the biggest meaningful win was Binghamton. And honestly, the Vermont win is very curious to me, because they played Syracuse tight, who we'll talk about in a second. So between playing Syracuse tight, getting this win over Boston, having the schedule that they do, which includes a couple Ivies, I think they have Utah next. They're going to be some really interesting games. And it is absolutely a team that I think is going to be a sleeper, probably have an upset, a good one, have a very successful season, and a team that I am already going to be pulling for. If they can backdoor their way into the playoffs, that's a team that, like, you don't want to run into. So I like what I've seen from Vermont. Classic Tommy Burke being an absolute psychopath face-off guy. So anything about those three games?
Did he sprint back to the midline after a goal?
No, he's not that big of a dork. I've just spoken to him once, and it was one of the most electric conversations I've ever had in my life. We interviewed him to be a potential intern, and I was like, he is like the meathead. Oh, yeah, you know, I just got done eating a raw steak and then bench pressed 350. But it's so genuine that it doesn't come off as cringe. I'm just like, you're just a lunatic who genuinely enjoys being a lunatic. And I pull for guys like that. If it's insincere, it's the worst thing of all time. But he's such a genuine character that you got to give him props. So,
well, let's take that opportunity to segue to talking about another one of your former interns who we should all be pulling for this season.
Yes. So Colin Reich, he intern Coolin, he plays for St. Joe's, and unfortunately his mother passed away recently, and it was due to breast cancer. I'm going to pull up the message here real quick. So if I fumble over my words, I apologize, but one of the things that they're going to be doing the entire year. So his mother died on December 29th, and the team is honoring her memory with MMP decals on their helmets. If you get a chance to go look at them, support, please do so. Over the entire course of the season, they are going to use this as motivation to raise funds for metastatic breast cancer research. There's a lot of money being raised in general for breast cancer, but metastatic, which means that the breast cancer returns, is almost always fatal, and there's, relatively speaking, few research dollars spent on it. So Colin, the entire team, the entire lacrosse community, Bob Reich, his dad, I've spoken with him before, a great family. Everybody keep them in your prayers. And as you move forward with this lacrosse season, appreciate what you have first and foremost. I think that's always one of the biggest takeaways. Call your grandparents, tell your mom you love her, tell your dad you love them, put up with their weird stuff, because you do got to cherish every minute. So as far as moving forward, everybody please keep an eye out for GoFundMes to support and give a lot. You know, the lacrosse community has always been one of the best support systems that anybody could ask for. Unfortunately, it does show its head in moments of tragedy, which has happened recently. So, Colin, you're in our thoughts and prayers, and we're looking forward to supporting you all season.
Prayers up, Colin.
And always weird to transition out of that and then talk more lacrosse. Well,
we have one more story to talk about, and it is absolutely the most ridiculous story of the first 9 days of the college lacrosse.
Which is Notre Dame not playing.
So we call this week one, but we really should call it week 0.5. And I felt like week 0.5 absolutely delivered. But when it comes to like ranking these 20 teams on Monday, the fact that like seven of them or eight of them still haven't played a game is really tough, especially when it comes to insufferable fan bases. Syracuse fans are going to be all over me for ranking Syracuse too low, no matter where I rank them. Which is hysterical because they were very willing to or ready to eat their young after a 7-5 win over Vermont in their season opener. What a difference 6 days makes, and they came away with a substantial one-sided win over Albany on Friday. And as we record this, they have pulled away, and I think we're leading 15-6 heading into the fourth quarter against Holy Cross. But they weren't feeling great about Jordan Evans 2.0, quote-unquote, which is what some message board folks refer to Joey Scalina as after a 1-for-15 shooting performance, which is outrageous on multiple fronts and unduly mean to Jordan Evans. But, Nick, what was your reaction to that moment?
The reaction of them winning of 1-for-15.
Everything.
It was interesting. My initial reaction was, God, it's fun when Syracuse sucks ass and you just get a dog pile on their alumni. Evan, you nerd. So I like miserable fan bases in general, but Syracuse in particular has been the tastiest of tears. But also it's another thing that's completely overplayed when it's like, oh, college lacrosse is better when Syracuse is a good team. Very few teams I think you could say that about. I do think that Syracuse is one of those teams. And it's objectively cool because rarely do you get to see the hype around a recruit, the immediate impact that he has. I could give a shit that he went 1-for-15, honestly. I love that quote, would rather go 1-for-15 than 1-of-2 because that meant that I, you know, didn't have the confidence to keep shooting. Love that he went 1-for-15. Yep. And rarely, especially in college lacrosse, just with kids being young, having to mature, go into a system, you get to see what this team, or at least what a big factor of this team is going to be like for the next 4 years. So watching him, knowing that we get four straight years of him producing, you know, barring anything transfer portal, God forbid any injuries, anything like that, I objectively enjoy knowing that Syracuse is going to be decent or at least watchable for the next 4 years, unlike they were last year, especially with Dordovic hitting the transfer portal and knowing that this freshman is going to be one of the guys. It's neat. I like it. And yeah, you beat two teams that aren't very good. I think Vermont's better than people give them credit for, as we just talked about. I think this is a good Syracuse team, and I'm excited that we get 4 years of it. What do you got?
So with respect to Joey in particular, I thought Patrick McEwen put it really well when we talked about it on Sunday or Monday. I've never seen a player get to his spot as easily, as frequently, and as consistently as Joey did and not be good. And so for as weird of a stat line as 1-for-15 is, I agree. It wasn't alarming. He didn't turn the ball over. I thought that there were a couple of assist opportunities that got dropped. I wasn't concerned. By the same token, don't really react very strongly to what he's done in the subsequent two games by putting up either, I don't know, combined, what do you have? Like, he shot 3-of-5 on Friday, and I think he was like 5-of-7 today. So now he's up to 9 goals on the season, averaging 3 goals a game, shooting like 32 or 33% on the year. That's fine. None of that matters because that's not going to be his role, right? Like, his role is to facilitate this team in its offense. He needs to score when the opportunities present itself in order to keep defenses honest and make sure that the spacing is working for all of his teammates. But like, he is going, like, Joey's real reason for being a number one recruit is like his ability to contribute while also being malleable and fitting in. And I think that for me, that was what I was seeing. Like he needs to learn what his role is with this group, and this group needs to learn like how it works together. And so it was always going to be, you know, a work in progress, so to speak. Finn Thompson is awesome. That comes as no surprise. Their middies who were high school attackmen need time to adjust. That also comes as no surprise. Jackson Birtwistle has been fantastic. I didn't realize that he was capable of this. And Owen Hiltz, in my opinion, is still, I don't know, he just doesn't seem like he's all the way back yet. So there's a lot of meat on the bone. You know, I don't know where I'm going to rank him. I haven't done that exercise yet.
Rank lower than you think you should. I'll Venmo you $20 to corrupt the rankings and not rank Syracuse at all. What are your thoughts?
I don't see how – well, first of all, they're not going to be ranked as high as Hopkins because none of their wins are nearly as impressive as a win over Georgetown. And second of all, you know, I think Hopkins – so I was texting with somebody when Georgetown was up like 11-9 early in the fourth quarter, and I was like, Georgetown is my number one team, and Hopkins might be as high as 10. And then obviously Hopkins won. Georgetown is not going to be my number one team. I don't know how high to put Hopkins. Like, that is a very difficult question. Syracuse is probably like 15 right now based on these three wins. They'll have an opportunity against Maryland. Maryland might be like 7 to 10. So that might not even be as, you know, significant of a win as we would have expected. So, yeah, a lot left to unfold. And, you know, as you mentioned, Notre Dame hasn't even played yet.
I have Syracuse more in like the 35 to 40 range. So that's just where my personal take is. Here's an idea. Let's invite a free open bar to Syracuse and Hopkins fans on a little boat I like to call the SS Titanic, round two. And how much better is college lacrosse if that happens? So, good for Syracuse, good for Hopkins. I'm excited to see you guys lose. Running out of steam here, honestly. Virginia.
We're done, man.
Virginia's good. Virginia, that's all
on.
I got.
They held on against
Virginia's
Michigan.
Good.
Yeah, they're good. I'm not sure they're great. I'm not sure they're great. I want to see more. I haven't gotten an opportunity to watch much of that game yet. But, you know, the conditions of the game, I would have expected a more controlled victory for the Cavaliers if they are as good as reasonable expectations suggest that they should be. So we'll talk more about Michigan and Virginia in the future. But the Cavaliers pulled away late, and I think they won 17-13 over the Wolverines.
It was. I still encourage you, if you're listening to this, go find that 30-second clip of just absolute mayhem. It honestly was like the TV timeout in semi-pro, somebody hit somebody version of lacrosse. So, with that being said, episode one in the books. I honestly like playing host. I again hate to compliment, especially to your face on a screen. This is just going to piss me off. I could have rosters and I could spend all day and a week. I still don't know how you just know all the rosters, all the names, everything off the top of your head. It's legitimately impressive. And I'm excited for episode two.
Hell yeah. Let's keep it rolling.
All right, love you.
The Tailgate Podcast. Love you, Nick.